and close the door to my office here just to make things good. Hold on 1 second.
Okay.
So Sally is in like...
Sally's on one.
I'm on.
She's good. So her sound levels, you want to check her sounds?
It's a little low, isn't it?
All righty. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Yes, hi, we Kim. Can it's Sally.
Hey.
How are you? Finally, we're connecting. I'm so glad.
Yeah, I'm sorry. It's been a trouble.
Wow. It sounds like you've been busy. Are you completely exhausted?
Well, it's been a busy few weeks. Let's just say that.
I know. But kind of busy in a good way, huh?
Yeah. Yeah, totally exciting time.
It really is. It's sort of thrilling. So I apologize. We're just a few minutes late. Our phones have been so quirky. They've been working and not working. And now we're in a radio studio and we're going to record you. So we're just checking to make sure that
good to go, right?
Everything is working. Are we good to go?
All right, guys, we are ready to go when you are.
Okay, perfect. Okay, so Kim, you can hear us, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, perfect. Okay, great. So what we'll do is we'll just go through the interview, ask you the questions, anything else you'd like to say. We will then edit that, turn it into a transcript, edit it, post it as a written piece on our website, and then push it out as a podcast as well. And then, of course, we'll send it to you. So there are many ways it will get out there into the world. So
right.
So we'll just get started. So because this is a podcast, I need to... Kim, you're executive director, right?
I am, uh-huh.
Okay, great. My name is Sally Steenland. I'm director of the Faith and Progressive Policy Initiative here at the Center for American Progress. And with me today is Kim Bobo, executive director of Interfaith Worker Justice in Chicago. Kim, welcome. We're so glad to have you with us today.
Thank you, Sally.
So let's get started. You just held a National Days of Action for Just Jobs campaign just last week. So you're just coming off of that. Give us some highlights of the campaign.
Oh, well, in Houston, our interfaith group went from location to location, looking at where employers weren't paying people and demanding that they pay people. In Austin, they were working with the police department to get them to enforce the new state theft services law. In the Miami area, they issued a report on the wage theft bill that they had passed the previous year, showing how incredibly successful it was. In Chicago, folks went with some car wash workers to, again, try and get their wages back, but also kick off a whole campaign trying to organize and support car wash workers. So really, there were just events all over the country lifting up the issue of wage theft and connecting it to the crisis that we have in the nation.
Wage theft is a pretty self-explanatory term. I'm not sure a lot of people are familiar with it, though, even though it's quite common. Talk to us about wage theft, what wage theft is and how common it is.
Yeah. So wage theft is when an employer illegally doesn't pay workers for all their wages. So it's not paying minimum wage, it's not paying overtime, it's shorting them on hours, it's having workers start working before they clock in and then clock out and work longer after it. It's when employers steal tips from workers. It's when employers commit payroll fraud, which is when they call people independent contractors when they're employees in a way that not only steals from workers, but really steals from the public coffers. And I would like to say that these are isolated instances, but they are not. In fact, we have a national crisis right now of wage theft, where there was a large study done coordinated by the National Employment Law Project that interviewed over 4,300 low-wage workers. These are workers earning $10 an hour or less. It found that 1 out of 4 low-wage workers wasn't paid the minimum wage, and, of course, that's pretty low already. And then of those who actually work overtime, so more than 40 hours a week, 76% of workers weren't paid for it. I talk to workers all the time, Sally, and they tell me, well, my employer doesn't pay overtime, or my employer says, hey, if you want overtime, go find another job. I mean, they're just, there are employers, not all, of course, there are plenty of good employers, but unfortunately, there's a lot of employers that are just flagrantly violating the law.
So what in this economy where jobs are hard to get and employers may feel that they've got the upper hand, what do we do?
Well, the good news about wage theft is there's actually a lot of things we can do. So on the one hand, a little public shining the light on employers who aren't paying people seems to make a huge difference. We have a network of 26 worker centers around the country affiliated with Interfaith Worker Justice, and they have really honed the skill of taking a small group of workers and religious allies to meet with employers who haven't paid workers and just saying, hey, you need to pay these people right now. And, you know, most of the time we can get employers to actually pay people. So, again, just a little community action makes employers straighten up. I think some of them think nobody's watching, and if you and I are watching and we go meet with them, they'll actually do the right thing. So that's, you know, there's just a lot of direct action we can do. Secondly, we have got to build relationships and ties with our government agencies that are charged with enforcing the law. So there are about 1,000 investigators federally responsible for enforcing the Fair Labor Standards Act. They're all over the country. If there's one anywhere near you, you should go meet with them and see how you can help. There are also, in most states, not all states, but in most states, there's also state departments of labor. And these agencies are equally understaffed and overwhelmed. And, again, they need our support and work as well. So, again, there's a whole set of things in terms of building partnerships with these government agencies so we can help them with outreach, and we can't enforce the law, but we can support them in reaching out to workers. Thirdly, we need to be educating all young people and all workers, especially people who might not understand their rights, what their rights are in the workplace, because they need to, you know, it's easier to stand up if you know what your rights are. And so, again, in community colleges, in high schools, and in congregations where you have a lot of workers who may not know their rights, we need to be doing worker rights training. Fourthly, we have to both personally and in the institutions that we are a part of make sure that we're paying people fairly. So if you hire anybody in your home to clean, to cut your yard, to do any construction work, you need to ask how those workers are paid, because those are industries that are rife with wage theft. And so if you don't ask how workers are paid, you could well be contributing to a contracting system where workers are being paid unfairly or not paid for all their wages. That's both true personally and with our churches, synagogues, mosques, when we hire a janitorial firm or hire a landscaping firm. We have to be asking questions about how workers are paid. And finally, just a simple little thing is that if you go to a restaurant and you are not sure about the practices in that restaurant, you should pay your tip in cash, because you cannot be assured that workers, that restaurant servers will all get their tips if you don't pay it in cash.
That's all good advice, from public shaming to enforcing the law to helping workers know their rights. And it makes perfect sense that employers, you know, might, if they can keep some profits, and if workers won't say anything, they will. But if a lot of workers stand up, then that money that people have earned will go to them. Interfaith is in the name of who you are. You're Interfaith Worker Justice, and you mentioned religious allies going with workers to meet with employers. You've mentioned houses of worship. Talk about the faith aspect of what you do.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, all religious teachings are so strong on loving your neighbor as yourself, of caring for one another. And all our religious traditions have been really on the front lines of fighting poverty, right? And so you see, you know, soup kitchens and shelters, and I mean, we are really on the front lines of that. But, you know, you talk to anybody who's in leadership at a soup kitchen, at a shelter, at a sort of place that's really serving poor people, and they know that people are there either because they don't have jobs or they don't have jobs that pay enough. And so really what Interfaith Worker Justice is doing is we're really building on those faith commitments to people and to caring for people, and building on the direct service work that people have done for decades and really helping people move into both the public policy and the direct action efforts around trying to make sure workers get paid and get paid fairly. So it really, you know, it is so central to our faith to care about people, and this is just another way that we can more effectively care about our brother and sister.
And your Interfaith Worker Justice, so what are the different faiths that groups that you work with?
Mm-hmm. We have on the board, we have Christians, so Catholicism, Protestant. We have Jews. We have Muslims. We have a growing contingent of Buddhists involved in the work. And there are some Hindus, and certainly plenty of people who refer to themselves as spiritual but not connected to a denomination, because people share these core values. So we are widely interfaith, but again, we work with a range of people who share our values.
The work that you're doing, you've been doing for a long time, and it's work on economic equality. We now have a protest and a movement, the Occupy Wall Street movement, and what we now call the 99%. And the issue has gotten traction. People are, we see the media, we see the public debate now starting to include references to needing jobs and to fairness in terms of the economy and not just cutting the budget. Why do you think the issue is getting traction now?
Well, I think, you know, the inequality in the nation has clearly been growing for decades, right? And so, this is one of those issues that has just been simmering below the surface for a long while. And now, why exactly this moment the occupiers were able to kind of tap into this? I can't tell you, Sally, how grateful I am to them, and I pray for them daily, right?
Exactly.
I'm just like, praise God for these young people who've had the courage to, you know, put up tents. You know, I tell some of my colleagues, look, I'm not all that excited personally about sleeping in tents any longer.
Not in November.
That's right. In Chicago, right?
In Chicago. Right.
But God bless them for doing it and for really, I think, you know, they've captured the imagination and framed the issue in language that we can all understand. And so the combination of this historic, you know, growing inequality in the country, sort of the simmering frustration with it, and then this dramatic representation and confrontation combined with some really brilliant messaging around the 99%, you know, it has just taken off, and I think all of us who have been working on these issues for a long time are just tickled pink to have the nation really grappling with these questions of inequality in society. It is really, it gives you great hope. It gives me great hope that we might actually address some of these issues in a serious way. So God bless the Occupy Movement people.
Well, you guys did a great thing. You created a congregational discussion guide for a variety of different faiths and prayer services as well for Occupy Wall Street. The 99% is a theme of Occupy Wall Street, and there's a parable that has to do with Jesus and the lost sheep in the 99%, which I think was just a brilliant thing for you guys to do. So connect for us the parable and the protest.
Okay, well, the parable is really, it's a parable about, you know, there were 100 sheep and one of them got lost and, you know, the shepherd goes to find the one lost sheep. And it's really a parable around how, God really cares for each and every one of us, right? That's the main theme of the parable. And if one is lost, then, you know, God's gonna go care and find for that one. And basically what we've said is, you know, we've got a nation right now where 99% are being lost, right? The vast majority are not sharing in the prosperity of the society right now. And it, in the same way that God would care for the one, God certainly cares for the 99. And so we really use that sort of biblical imagery, which is, you know, a familiar passage for most in the Christian world, to really ask congregations to grapple with, you know, what does this mean for us as a congregation, and is there more we could be doing to help unemployed workers, to help those who haven't benefited in the growth over the last few decades. And so, our sense is, you know, there are a lot of people in congregations who don't quite know what to do and what to think about the Occupy movement, right? They, you know, frankly, are not all that keen about people who camp out on park grounds, and, you know, they just don't really understand what's going on. And yet they do fundamentally know that the levels of inequality that we have in the society are wrong and that we need to be doing something about it. And so we really felt like the Occupy movement, it's an opportunity to really have, as we refer to it, as a teachable moment, right?
Teachable moment, right.
That's right, a moment to really talk about these things. And you know, people have been doing that. I've been talking to people who've been using the study guides, and, you know, I think it is a great moment for people.
Do you think that this cuts across partisan and political lines, that this sense of the 99% and fairness is resonant within more conservative faith communities as well, or do you think that there are some political limits to it?
Well, I think that really does, this issue of disparity, the issue of people not sharing in the prosperity, that there needs to be some accountability. When you have wealth, responsibility and accountability comes with that as well. I think that's an issue that is really shared across the political spectrum. You know, Sally, I actually personally grew up in an evangelical home, you know, in the church. You know, half the folks were probably Republicans and half Democrats, but everybody cared about poor people. Everybody thought that, you know, that frankly there shouldn't be huge levels of disparity between rich and poor, that with wealth came enormous responsibilities, right? I was just working with, you know, to whom much has been given, much is expected, right? And I think that is a sense that you get across the political divides in this country among people of faith.
So just to go back to Occupy Wall Street for a minute, it seems to be in a bit of transition in some cities, at least, as Zuccotti Park and other places have been emptied out, and maybe a next phase is coming. What would you like to see happening in the coming weeks and months with the protests and the movement?
Well, I think I'd love to see us find some ways to have to channel the energy and excitement into some very visible wins for working people. You know, if you think back on the civil rights movement, you know, they were able to integrate lunch counters and force bus stations to integrate. I mean, they were able to have lots of local wins, right? And that kind of encouraged and got more people excited and more people thinking, oh, I could do this in my town kind of thing too. And so I think what we really have got to do is find some ways to get some wins, and they're probably not all going to be wins in Washington, right? Now, again, obviously, I'm hoping we can get an extension on the unemployment insurance, right?
Sure.
Obviously, there's some things that we'd all like to see, but are there ways that we can, you know, in the next year or two, can we get more local wage theft bills, right?
Mm-hmm.
We've won a few of those in the last few years. Could we pass a few more? Could we get... There have been paid sick day bills that have been won in several cities. Again, could we get 8 or 10 cities passing paid sick day bills? Could we, on public jobs, could we force an accountability on payment and on hiring around public jobs? So, again, I think there's a whole set of things that we could really win and work on that would be encouraging for building the movement.
The word worker is in your title of your organization, Worker Justice, and with wage theft and minimum wage, living wage, so many other issues you work on, the focus is on the worker. But you have a project called the Ethical Business Leaders Campaign, where there's a focus on business leaders. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, it's so interesting because, you know, there are around the nation all these sort of business ethics groups. But by and large, the question of wages and benefits is not even in the discussion. And yet, what's more central in terms of ethics for most workers than, like, how you get paid, right? I mean,
sure,
those are pretty fundamental kinds of issues, right?
Exactly.
And so we've really been trying to identify employers that, you know, have a personal commitment to paying people fairly and justly, and to not only acknowledge the good work that they do, but frankly, get them to step up and talk about it and push some of their colleagues in it. In my book, Wage Theft in America, I have a whole new chapter in the revised edition, a new chapter on ethical businesses. And some of them are so exciting because they're often businesses and owners who operate in sectors where a lot of folks are cheating workers, and yet they've made a personal decision. There's a woman runs a restaurant in San Francisco where, you know, she'd been in restaurants for years, and finally, when she got to own her own restaurant, she was like, hey, I'm going to do this differently, right? So she stopped paying people's independent contractors, right? She made sure everybody was paid as employees, and they got paid overtime. She began over the course of a couple years to provide health care, to provide sick days, to provide vacation days. And now in her restaurant group, she provides the highest wages and the highest benefits, and she has some of the highest profit margins in her whole sector, right? And so, again, you can do the right thing and do well. And what she says is when you do that, one, your employees really care about the restaurant, and two, there's not theft of wine and goods and whatever that is a common problem in restaurants because people get, you know, they're not paid right, and so they kind of take their pay in some weird and unhelpful ways, right? So again, you know, there are employers like that, and we've got to be lifting them up. We've got a workers' center in Ithaca, New York, called the Tompkins County Workers' Center, and they've created a living wage certification, and they've certified 70 businesses as businesses in their community that are paying people fairly and justly. We are really trying to find ways to honor, respect, and lift up these ethical business leaders who are doing the right thing.
And as you said, it sounds like that's the smart thing to do, too, because when people are earning a living wage, they can spend money and they can
Absolutely.
Buy things, which helps the economy.
Yeah, I mean, our whole message on this stuff is that when we stop wage theft, it is first good for workers and their families. Secondly, it's good for ethical businesses, right, because it levels the playing field when we stop wage theft from their competitors. Thirdly, it is good for public coffers. If employees are being paid all their wages and their employers are paying payroll taxes and workers' comp and unemployment insurance, that's good for the public coffers. And finally, it is good for the economy. It stimulates the economy to put wages in the hands of workers. I mean, nothing is clearer for stimulating the economy than making sure workers get paid.
That's absolutely right. I've got one last question for you, Kim. So yesterday, the Super Committee announced its failure to come to any agreement, which is not news in Washington. So we see a lot of dysfunction in Congress. Both political parties at each other's throats. And there's a seeming inability of political leaders to solve our national problems on the national level. But yet when you go out into states, as you do, when you run campaigns, when you just told the story of the woman in San Francisco and exciting stories in Houston and other places, you see people actually rolling up their sleeves, solving problems, getting things done. So when you do that, when you travel around and see that, do you feel hopeful? Does despair sort of wash over you? Do you feel a little bit of both? What's your emotional temperature there?
Well, it is much more hopeful when you're out around the country and seeing the really creative things people are trying, and frankly, where people are really winning some stuff, right? We're making progress. You know, a year ago, there was no enforcement agency in the entire state of Florida to help enforce the state laws on wages. State legislature in Florida literally a few years ago voted out their Department of Labor. So there was no Department of Labor. And so in Miami, Dade County, they put together basically a wage theft bill that created a local wage theft enforcement agency in the Small Business Administration. And this last year, they helped workers collect $700,000 in back wages.
Wow.
Right? Wow. It's a great thing. And so Palm Beach County, right next to it, is trying to do the same thing. They're trying to get, you know, their own little enforcement agency. So, again, people are responding to the crisis, trying to create new structures, trying to find new ways to protect workers. And, yes, I am very encouraged around the country. I'm certainly a little less encouraged when I watch Congress.
Yeah.
It is disheartening. And, you know, it does seem like, you know, the effects of money and politics is showing its ugly head in Congress.
But it is very important to raise up these good news stories of problem solving and victories, as you just did. Florida, if you listen to the national news or whatever, seems like it's a conservative takeover state where not much progressive is happening on the ground, and yet that's not true. So to give people hope and to show best practices and even a roadmap for how to go, stories like yours like your groups are just crucial to share.
Well, thanks.
Is there anything else you'd like to say? Is anything I haven't asked you?
Well, I think the only other thing is if somebody wants to get involved with Interfaith Worker Justice, if
how
they
to
want
do that?
To get on our action list, you can go to our website, which is www.iwj.org, and you can sign up to get our e-alerts and get involved. And we also have a very active Interfaith Worker Justice Facebook page. We'd love to become friends on Facebook and would really love to connect with people at any time.
And one last thing, your book.
Oh, yes, the book. You can get it from your local union bookstore, from Powell's. You can get it from Amazon. You can get it from the New Press, which is the publisher. Anyway, so it's available around. And
the title is?
It's Wage Theft in America, Great. Why Millions of Working Americans Are Not Getting Paid and What We Can Do About It.
Sounds perfect. You state the problem and then how to solve it. Very American, right?
That's right. That's right.
Thanks so much, Kim, and happy Thanksgiving.
Same to you, Sally. Thank you.
Take care. Bye.
All right. Bye-bye.